This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Romanians are trying to build a democracy. One of the tough questions they face is what to do with the Securitate, Nicolae Ceaușescu's secret police, who spied on Romanians and tortured the regime's opponents. Will the secret police be executed, imprisoned, or reintegrated into society? How does a fledgling democracy settle accounts with the torturers from the old regime? This is the subject of the new book, A Miracle, A Universe, by Lawrence Weschler. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and wrote about Eastern Europe throughout the 80s. Weschler's new book examines two Latin American countries that recently made the transition from dictatorship to democracy. In Brazil, a small group of torture victims and human rights activists entered into a dangerous conspiracy to get even with the torturers in a nonviolent way. In Uruguay, there was a popular movement to overturn the amnesty that was granted to the military. Weschler says that it's very difficult for a society to recover from the use of torture as a weapon of social and political control.
In the same way that a torture victim doesn't recover simply from being released from prison, but in fact torture has a tremendous impact on the rest of his life and can have destroyed it, torture societies don't recover simply by holding elections. I mean, this is the great kind of thing in the press right now is that all these countries are becoming democracies, whether in Eastern Europe or in Latin America. But in fact, they have tremendous problems left over from the torture experience, and particularly from the experience of secrecy, of denial, of the military refusing to open the books and to allow even trials or let alone truth-tellings about what actually took place.
Let's look at the example of Brazil. Now, amnesty was given to the torturers in Brazil.
Right.
But there was a movement of torture victims and human rights activists to make public who the torturers were by publishing a book. And the book was based on military records. Can you describe the records that were the foundation of this book?
If people can't get over this. The Brazilian military, who took over, by the way, in a coup in 1964, aided and abetted by the United States. The Brazilian military were technocrats. They kept records. They did everything by the book. And in effect, they ended up keeping minutes of the torture sessions themselves. Not exactly. What happened is that they would have these kind of kangaroo courts. The main evidence against the person would be the confession elicited under torture. When the confession was read into the record, the person would say, but I was tortured, and would describe how he was tortured. And the stenographer would sit there and type it all up. So that by 1979, when the military declared an amnesty for itself, it was in fact the case that there was a whole archive of these court records in the basement of the Supreme Military Court building in Brasilia. And it wasn't so much a movement in Brazil. It was just a very small group of people who were protected under the umbrella of Cardinal Arns of Sao Paulo, who's an extraordinary liberation theologian cardinal in South America. Anyway, these people got the idea on an overnight basis, surreptitiously, to kind of check out these documents as if they were just doing research of a completely different sort, check them out overnight, Xerox them, return them the next morning. It was completely against the idea of what should be done with these documents. It was very dangerous for them to be doing this. They were sure they would get caught, but they would Xerox them. They would spirit the Xeroxes down to Sao Paulo. They would microfilm them in Sao Paulo and then to get the microfilms out of the country. They thought they would get caught at some point, but at least there would be some evidence of what had actually gone on. They wouldn't be able to deny that this had happened. And instead, what happened is that they weren't caught. They went on for 3 years doing this. One day, they realized that they had over 1 million pages of Xeroxed pages, and they had the entire universe of documents in the archive. That's one of the reasons I call the book A Miracle, A Universe. One of the universes involved is the entire universe of torture had been reproduced by these people. They then set about compiling, computerizing it, doing all sorts of analyses. They eventually had a 27-volume history. They had the 444 torturers named. They had where the tortures had taken place, the kinds of torture, the names of the victims, and so forth. They condensed that to a single volume. They published that volume with absolutely no fanfare whatsoever on June 15th, 1985. On June 30th, 1985, it reached number one on the Brazilian bestseller lists. It remained number one for the next year. It is now the single best-selling book in the history of Brazil, a book of nonfiction.
It's really remarkable that these records continue to exist after the military dictatorship stopped existing. Aren't these records usually destroyed?
They probably would have been destroyed in the process of the transition. The transition kind of went from 1979, when that amnesty was announced, as a kind of early phase of it. It culminated in 1985 with a semi-free election. No doubt during that period, at some point, they would have tried to destroy them. I asked one of the people, you know, how could you have gotten away with this? And, you know, they said efficiency, luck, and divine protection. Another person, I said, how could you have gotten away with this? And he said, it was because after all those years of dictatorship, they couldn't even imagine that somebody would be doing this. And I think that's really true. It didn't even occur to them that somebody would do this. By the way, very early on in their compiling of records, they're Xeroxing, they realized that one of the main torturers back in his days, 10 years earlier as a young corporal or something, had risen in the meantime to become the head of the Brazilian FBI, in effect the man whose job it was to prevent this from happening.
Hmm.
And he would have had a personal reason to do so if he had even heard about it. And yet for 5 years they were able to keep it a secret.
When information was disclosed about who the torturers were, were there any surprises there? I mean, were they mostly people who were in the military who you'd expect to have that role or expect to have that role? But you know what I mean. were there any people who were really surprising who showed up on those lists?
There were some surprises in the sense that the Brazilian military is so bound up in kind of the industrial complex. I mean, they were very, very much in charge of running the technologizing of the economy. So it turned out that these people in fairly high positions in at this point, I mean, I don't have particulars at this moment, but, you know, automobile factories or ambassadors to various countries and so forth turned out to have been on that list. And so there were quite a few scandals. There was a guy who was now the transportation director of Sao Paulo, the guy in charge of the bus system and so forth, was on that list.
Once the names of torturers were made public in this book in Brazil, what happened to them? I mean, there was an amnesty, so they weren't going to be imprisoned as a result of their names being made public. But I'm sure once the word was out, people would react to them very differently.
I think there was some of that. I mean, at one level, it was disappointing in the sense that, you know, nobody went to jail. There was this amnesty. On the other hand, I think to them personally, there was a kind of stigma attached to them, as well there ought to be. Some of them had their careers stymied to some extent. Some of them kind of became cause célèbres of kind of renegade elements of the military. And even though in Brazil there was an amnesty, it was sustained, even in Uruguay the amnesty ended up being sustained, those generals who are now next time going to order torture to take place, those torturers whose whole life is based on the fantasy that nobody will ever know, no longer can sustain that fantasy. Because who knows what will happen in the future? These are two amazing examples of entirely different things happening.
Lawrence Wechsler is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and we're talking about his new book, A Miracle, A Universe, Settling Accounts with Torturers. I think a point that you make in your book is that for some torture victims, truth is more important than retribution.
Yeah.
That the main thing is that people know what happened and who was responsible for it.
Over and over again, you see this. And that torture victims are not out for revenge. Conversely, over and over again you hear by kind of apologists for the military or people who believe that we have to put the past behind us, this is just revenge, you know, this is petty, you know, we've got more important things, we've got a democracy to secure. The fact of the matter is that countless times I interviewed torture victims who said, look, I don't want anybody to go to jail. If anyone, I know what jail is about. In Uruguay, which is a small country, repeatedly, again and again, torture victims encounter their torturers on the street. And I have one amazing interview with Luis Perez Aguirre, a priest in Uruguay who was leading the movement to overturn the amnesty in Uruguay. And yet when he encountered his torture victim on the street, he pulled him into a coffee shop, sat down with him, asked him how he was, told him that he forgave him personally, But having said that, he pointed out it's up to me to forgive him. It's not up to the military to forgive itself, or up to the democracy with a gun to its head to forgive the military, or even a democratic vote, which eventually happened in Uruguay with the military holding a gun to the electorate's head. It's not up to them to forgive.
I'll tell you, it's one thing to feel that that you can offer somebody forgiveness. It's another thing to take them out to a cup of coffee and have a schmooze with them. I find that really hard to understand.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you frankly one thing about that is that this may sound romantic, but the sorts of people that get tortured are better people than the sorts of people that do the torturing. These people, Perez Aguirre, the people in Brazil, Cardinal Arns, and so forth, are some of the most remarkable, large-hearted people, courageous, going back to the root of courage, which is in heart, cœur in French, and going back to Latin. And these people are of full hearts. And that is precisely why they were being tortured. It's that kind of person who was standing up to the regimes, to the dictatorship on behalf of other people and so forth. They had more kind of empathy for other people than perhaps some other people do. But in any case, over and over again, you see these people who finally also have not had the essential thing tortured out of them. Mm-hmm. They have not had fellow feeling tortured out of them, which is one of the functions of the torture in the first place.
Let's look at the country of Uruguay. When that became a democracy, the president declared amnesty for torturers. But then there was a campaign to have a referendum that would overturn the amnesty. What was the argument for giving amnesty to the torturers?
It's a fairly strong argument, actually, and I have an interview with the president who makes it very clear. It took a little bit longer than that. What happened, to understand about Uruguay, by the way, Uruguay had been one of the foremost democracies in the world up until 1973. It was called the Sweden of Latin America. It had a laughable military and so forth. It then became the most repressed country on a per capita basis in terms of political incarceration in the world. It was a little city-state. It's just a city. It's Montevideo, population 1.5 million, and the countryside population 1.5 million. And so in a situation like that, the military was able to really set up a kind of Orwellian totalitarian system that had an incredible amount of torturers. On a per capita basis, comparing the United States, every single person in Seattle would have been tortured extensively. If it were the United States, in a country of 3,500,000 went into exile. So there was a horrible legacy. Anyway, as Uruguay emerged from this military dictatorship, the country was shaken. I think people were kind of stooped. They were in some way broken, and the military demanded an amnesty, got one. When I was interviewing President Sanguinetti, who was a very impressive man and who was one of the proponents of this amnesty, I quoted for him this line of Zbigniew Herbert, you know, that ignorance about those who have disappeared undermines the reality of the world. And this man's quite an intelligent man. He quoted me poem for poem. And he quoted a poem by Ernesto Renan to the effect that nations are built on great rememberings and great forgettings. And he pointed out that the French were still haggling over, you know, the St. Bartholomew Day massacre. They'd be killing each other to this day. But at a certain point, you have to let go of these things. You don't want to do it. It's not something you want to do. But in order to build the future, you need to do it. Another person who surprisingly was in favor of sustaining the amnesty in Uruguay was Jacobo Timmerman, the Argentinian. And he said to me that it was complicated, that it's not just a question of the political thing to do versus the ethical thing to do, that there's short-term ethics, which are the completely just ethics of, you know, recompense and redemption for the victim, but there's long-term ethics that it doesn't happen again, that there be a democracy 10 years from now. I mean, I end up having strong feelings in one direction, but I don't in any way deny how complex the issues are.
You were saying before that it's often the case that torture victims are ready to forgive their torturers and move on. Does the case of Uruguay contradict that? Uruguay, where torture victims and human rights activists got together to organize a referendum that would overturn the amnesty.
Yeah. I mean, it was an incredibly arduous thing that they got together to do. They got together to get 25% of the country to sign a petition which would allow the referendum not only to sign but to provide their ID numbers. It was a very arduous process. In the face of a military that was saying, "Go ahead, sign that. You know, that's the list we'll use next time we come back into power." And then once they got that number, there was almost a filibuster to deny that they had done so. The electoral court threw out all kinds of signatures. It was a tremendously arduous process. Having said that, over and over again, I spoke with leaders of that campaign, who said what we want is trials. We want the truth to come out. We want the torturers cashiered out of the military, for example. We don't want them rising. We don't want, you know, former torturers to be the head of various, you know, we don't want doctors who took place in torture to be the head of military hospitals, which is in fact the case in Uruguay right now. We want a truth-telling, and after that, we're all for a pardon. But you can't pardon somebody, they would say, for something they don't admit to having done.
Well, the human rights groups lost the referendum, and the amnesty was not overturned. Was there still a level of victory here?
I think there was. First of all, in 1987, 86, when this process began, there was a real attempt to forget what had happened. And the whole campaign ventilated. There was a lot of truth-telling that took place during that campaign. Beyond that, I think that at the end of the day, the military was really chastened in Uruguay. They won that vote, but it was a close call. They could have lost it. I think they realized that. And parenthetically, the young people in Uruguay who had grown up under this Orwellian system of education, who you would have thought had been brainwashed by the military, in fact, voted overwhelmingly to overturn the amnesty.
Lawrence Wechsler is my guest, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book, A Miracle, A Universe, Settling Accounts with Torturers. Well, in Romania, one of the things under consideration now is how to deal with the Securitate, the former secret police. How is that issue being handled now? What are some of the referendums before the Romanian people?
Well, Romania remains an extremely complicated situation. Sometimes it's strange. I mean, I read stuff coming out of Haiti and I think of Romania and vice versa. In Romania, you had a really fiendish situation where some estimates of upwards of a quarter of the population were in some way involved with the Securitate. That doesn't mean they were all torturers, but they were all informing on each other and so forth. Or in any case, there was the impression that that was going on. And there was certainly a great deal of torture. By the way, it's worth noting that this is another one of these countries that, for geopolitical reasons, the United States basically turned a blind eye on that torture. Ceausescu was the great independent ally of Israel, blah, 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 and we weren't going to look too deeply into what was going on. In any case, that country desperately needs some forum for truth-telling, for establishing what took place, and at the same time, by the way, for protecting the rights, the legitimate rights, legal rights of people who are accused. That's, by the way, one of the reasons you need to have these things as trials, as judicial processes, and not just publications of books, because, you know, people can get accused and they don't have any due process. And in the short term, Romania has tried to limit discussion of these issues to the immediate events surrounding the December revolution and to try and more or less say, we don't have time. Look, we've got so many things we have to do. We don't have time to look much more deeply. There's a good deal of suspicion that some of the people who are in the Romanian government are still affiliated or with Securitate or had Securitate pasts. You get a lot of that same sort of thing in East Germany right now, where over and over again, leaders of these parties are turning out to have been, or at least to have been accused to have been informers for the security forces. So Romania, I feel pretty bleak about, partly because there's no framework of a judicial system at this point. There aren't lawyers or aren't human rights lawyers specializing in this. That country was civil society in that country was really asphyxiated for 40 years, and worse and worse as the years went by, and worse of all in the last 10 years. So they've got a lot of work to do.
Just a few years ago, the UN General Assembly had a convention on torture, and it drafted an international system for the prosecution of torturers. Mm-hmm. If that was signed and put into effect, what kind of model would it offer?
Well, it's not so much it wasn't that there would be international courts, but there certainly would be international monitoring. And to the extent that nations had signed the convention, which not that many have, there would be sanctions or there would be the right for sanctions against them. There would also be the opportunity for victims of disappearances, for instance, to go to regional courts. This is more inter-American human rights law and so forth. There are various things like that. Parenthetically, the United States has not signed those conventions.
Why not?
We have all sorts of relationships with countries that are based on torture, to put it bluntly. I mean, El Salvador or Chile and so forth. I think rhetorically we'd say that's interference with internal life of these countries and so forth.
In your research, did you meet any of the torturers?
No, I did not.
Could you have? I mean, could you have, but you just decided not to?
It would have been a different sort of book. There are some people who are doing that, and it's something I may yet do. Entirely different thing. And by the way, I mean, it would be a book about a mystery.
The mystery of why people do it.
Of how it can happen, yeah.
Okay.
By the way, I mean, having said that, one other thing to say is that have I met torturers? Yes, I mean, you meet them at news conferences in Washington, D.C., in a sense. I mean, we are funding, supported a lot of these regimes. And people in this country in three-piece suits voted obliviously to support this sort of behavior. So in a way, you can meet torturers on your TV screen every night.
Lawrence Wechsler. His new book, A Miracle, A Universe, is published by Pantheon. Wechsler is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.